We're continuing with Parshat Chayei Sarah. Eliezer is in the house of Bethuel, and after he gives his pitch about the girl, so the Pasuk attests that Lavan and Bethuel answered. And the Pasuk is pointing out to us how Lavan didn't have respect. He's answering before his father. And the laws of respect, of respecting one's parent, so it says you're not even supposed to say you're right, Dad. By saying you're right, what you're basically saying is, I call the shots whether you're right or wrong. This time I decided you were right, and another time I might decide you're wrong. So to say you're right is like getting in the last word, so to speak. You know, the old joke, the husband comes in and pounds his fist on the table and says, I get the last word in this house. And the wife says, yes, dear. So they're the same thing. When a son says, you're right, Dad, what he's saying is, I'm in a position to tell you if you're right or wrong. So here it's even worse. Lavan answers before his father. And our sages had a tradition that Bethuel wanted to kill Eliezer, that he poisoned the soup, and that an angel came and switched the soups, and then Bethuel dropped dead during that meal. So Rivka is leaving her parents' house actually in mourning. She's leaving her parents when she just lost her father. And that explains why the next morning, the ones that are seeing her off are her mother and Lavan. It doesn't say Bethuel's anywhere to be seen. Where is he? I was once quoted a medrash I never saw inside that says that the Bethuel instituted in that city that every virgin had to mate with him before she'd get married. And this included even the smallest children. And the people of the town gathered around Bethuel and said, well, you did it to our daughters, you're doing it to your daughter too. If no one else was able to marry a virgin, your daughter isn't getting away with this. And that's why he had the name Bethuel, like Bethulim. Bethulim is hymen. So according to that medrash, that's why it was so important that Bethuel would drop dead that night, so that Rivka would leave unscathed, which is what happens the next morning. Now we understand a little bit better why Eliezer is in such a rush to get out of there before they appoint a new Bethuel to get her clean to Yitzchak. So Bethuel and Lavan and Bethuel approved the shidduch. Well, how are they so quick to approve it? So the simple reading of the verses is they liked money. Oh, they got gifts. They got a good shidduch for their daughter. Everyone knows Avram. But the Ibn Ezra has another interpretation. He says, Abraham keeps wishing Eliezer. He keeps telling him, God should send his angel before you. The angel should take care of things for you. What happened? So the Ibn Ezra and others say that that's the angel of dreams. So that the night beforehand, the Bethuel and Lavan, and everyone's dreaming about how someone's going to, a knight in shining armor is going to ride into town and take their daughter for her shidduch. So the next morning, their dreams come true. So that's why they say, God sent this. How come Lavan and Bethuel are talking about God suddenly? Because they had this premonition the night before that this is what's going to happen. That's Abraham's blessing when Avram tells him, God should send his angel before you. So, yeah.
Where did Bethuel kill Eliezer?
Take his wealth and keep the girl.
So I thought you just came with a star, though.
What?
I read in maybe Rashi that you came with a star.
Right.
So, is that what you give it?
Well, I don't know if they'd get the rest of the wealth. The star showed that Yitzchak was extraordinarily wealthy. But now they'd keep all the camels. Now they'd keep all 10 camels and all the wealth. That's one famous pshat in Arami Oved Avi. The Aramean wanted to destroy my forefathers because had Eliezer died, so then Yitzchak would have never known who he was married to. Legally, maybe he's married, maybe not. Who could he marry? Maybe it's the sister of someone he married. He'd have to find a girl who he knows from the minute she was born, that her mother couldn't have been the one, that Eliezer engaged, that her mother was always married, that she couldn't have been engaged, that she has no sisters. So it would have really complicated things. Had he not known if he's married to someone out there, he would have had to find some girl that he could marry. It's not so simple to find a girl. If you don't know who you're married to, so you have to entertain the idea that maybe I'm married to this girl's mother, unless her mother's married. Maybe I'm married to her sister, unless she has no sisters or they're all married. And you have to ensure that you're not married to a relation you can't marry.
But his son got married to two sisters.
That's a good question. Okay. Well, you see, but they couldn't live into the land of Israel. One died very young. Yeah.
Can you please clarify the indication that Bethuel and Lavan had a dream of this happening the night before?
Because Avram blesses Eliezer. He tells him, God should send his angel before you. And that should cause your success. So what angel was sent before him? So the interpretation goes that the angel that preceded him was the angel of dreams, to ensure that they would have dreams. And that helps us understand how come Lavan and Besuel, that are really, they're pagans, how come they're talking about God, the Tetragrammaton? Lavan runs out to greet him and says, Bo Baruch Hashem, come blessed in the name of, and he uses the Tetragrammaton. And then they say, Mei Hashem Yatza Adavar. This is obviously the handiwork of God. Why? Why do they think so?
They're really just using, you say they're using the name of Hashem.
That's what the Torah says. Look at the Torah. You'll see that's the term they used. So that's one interpretation over here of what's going on. Back to our... So Lavan and Besuel, so Besuel dies, and Lavan and the mother are seeing Rivka off, and Eliezer insists we're going, and they say, give her some time, give her a little bit of time to prepare herself, and Eliezer says, don't detain me, this is a success, make it work. How does he answer their question? So sometimes in life the key is not to answer questions. Sometimes you have to be a bulldozer. People ask questions and you don't answer the questions. You explain, I got to get there. You guys ever notice that? You're standing on line and a guy's cutting you, starts saying, excuse me, there's line. He says, I'm sorry, I just have to go. And you say, what do you mean, sir? I'm sorry, I just have to go. And at some point, you're just like, you're not going to fight him. So Eliezer is playing it dumb. He's saying, she lost her father. They're saying, let her prepare herself. There is such a halacha. You give a girl 12 months to prepare herself. And Eliezer says, don't detain me now. This is going good. We're going to keep this going. Yeah.
But also, by accepting the question, you have to accept the question.
Right.
I never understood the whole concept. 12 months, because I understand you're going to get yourself beautiful, take a couple of days, maybe a week to get the pimples out, whatever, the acne, but like, how much could you prepare yourself already, for a year?
So
spiritually, physically?
No, the idea was to prepare a dowry. You got to prepare a set of blankets, prepare a set of pillows, prepare a set of pots and pans. In those days, everything was handmade, so you have a lot to prepare. Anyway, she has to get a false tooth to get the exact match, not so simple. Things are more difficult to get the olive oil that's made that's from olives that are only a third ripe, so that it would soften the skin the way they did back then. It's not so easy. Today you go to your pharmacy, you get all the creams. They had a lot of work put in to get it right. She needs to get the right dye for her hair, all the perfumes.
We're wondering about the false tooth.
Yeah.
False tooth?
False tooth.
False tooth?
Sure. The Talmud says there was once a chassan who didn't want to marry his kala. So they brought the kala, I think it was to Rabban Gamliel. And the chassan said, well, she's disgusting. I don't want to marry her. So Rabban Gamliel says, you go to the other room. We're going to take care of her. And he called in his wife and he told her, take her, shower her, comb her hair, set her up beautifully. And then he saw she's missing a tooth. So he said, 1 second. Pulled out a tooth of his. Said, put that one in. And and he said, okay. Then he called in the guy, and she's all decked out, and she has this huge smile with her beautiful tooth, and the guy had taken a vow that I'm not marrying that girl. He took a vow in God's name. So he asked him, tell me, is this the girl you promised you wouldn't marry? So he looks at her, and he says, oh my gosh, no, that's a girl I'll marry. So he says, fine, you see, the daughters of Israel are beautiful, just the poverty that covers it up. And that was his famous line. The daughters of Israel are beautiful. It's the poverty that covers it up. So I said a false tooth. Of course, she needs it. If she's missing a tooth, she's got to get a false tooth.
It seems fairly simple to get a false tooth.
Missing a tooth for 3 years.
Where is there an indication that Rivka was missing a tooth?
I didn't say Rivka was missing a tooth. I meant in general, preparations take time, like getting false teeth and whatever else it would take.
Wasn't Rivka was 3 years old?
Rivka, according to the well-known opinion, was 3, but there is an opinion that says she was 15. That seems to work a little bit better, right? So, they send Rivka with Eliezer, and they're traveling, and Rivka has all her maids, her wet nurse with her, and she's traveling modestly behind Eliezer, even though we say ladies first. In Judaism, the way we apply that is take care of the lady first, but not that she should walk in front of you, because out of modesty we assume you should not have your eyes on her, and if she's walking in front, then the nature of a man that he's looking at her figure in front of him, and that's not right. So respecting her modesty, we don't say ladies first in that vein. We do say ladies first when it comes to taking care of things, when it comes to buying clothing, when it comes to a tight budget, when it comes to setting up tent, whose tent gets set up first. In many ways that are deemed respectful, then ladies first. But when it comes to actually walking, so we consider it not respectful to her to have her go first, because where are his eyes going to go? So we derive that from here, that it says Rebecca went behind him. He's traveling in the front, and she's traveling behind him. They're approaching Israel, and at the same time that Avram Avinu has been working to get Yitzchak a shiduch, Yitzchak Avinu has been working to get Avram a shiduch. That's why it says Yitzchak was at Be'er Lachai Roi. What's Be'er Lachai Roi? That's that well where Hagar says, wow, an angel appeared before me. She named the well Be'er Lachai Roi. So she stayed there. She said, if God appears here, this is where I'm staying. And so Yitzchak goes out there to look for her. And even though she is the daughter of the Pharaoh, so she's had a lot of suitors, she's a good shidduch, but she is keturah, she's kept herself closed, she has kept herself like a good spice, waiting for the one man in her life who never really married her, Avram. And now that Sarah passes away, she comes back and she is the same tzaddik as she was when he first married her, and so he remarries her, and now she's given that name keturah, a name of honor. Keturah is like the spices of ketores that are offered before Hashem. Keturah is like the word keshura, tied up, yeah.
I was going to ask the significance of the name Keturah, but you just answered it. Is that a name that Jewish people use ever?
I haven't heard it.
Okay. I think it's a nice name.
I'm just curious.
Okay.
How did he end up, like, how did he come into this whole thing of finding his own father on the way? It sounds interesting.
Why shouldn't he take care of his dad? His poor dad is now a widower. No, you see, he had many more children. The Midianite people come from Keturah and Avram. No, he's not too old. And part of what kids should do for their parents is try to help them get remarried. Chafetz Chaim's own kids. He thought he was an old man. He had nothing left to offer. And they got him a second wife, and they coaxed him, and they pushed him, and finally he got remarried. And he lived a few decades with her. He didn't know he'd lived to, I think, 93 or 97. In those days, people didn't live that long. But he did. So when he was in his 60s, he thought, like, what am I getting remarried for? And his kid said, no, Dad, we'll get you a good shidduch. And they pushed him, and he thanked them afterwards at the end of his life. He thanked them for pushing him to get remarried. And our sages say, if you married a woman in your youth, then get remarried as you're an old man too. If you brought children to the world in your youth, bring children when you're an old man too. If you taught students in your youth, teach students when you're an old man too. Why? Because you never know what's going to succeed. Look at Rabbi Akiva. 24,000 students, and none of them lived. They all perished with the revolts of Bar Kokhba. Only the last five, as an old man, he taught five, and they are the fathers of the oral law. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Eloi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Akiva taught his last five students. They're the ones that the Mishnah is filled with. They propelled the Mishnah forward. So you never know what's going to succeed. And Avraham Avinu remarries at the end of his days, and he has another few decades with Keturah, and he brings many more children to the world, as we'll see in a second. So Ashurim, the Tushim, the Umim, those are the grandchildren. But okay, so Avraham has a lot of children with her. What are his children? Zimran, Yikshan, Yishbak, Shuach, and Midian and Didan. So I think those are the names. Got to open up Chumash. Okay, so when Rivka is about to leave, Eliezer is ready, and Lavan and the mother come out, and they bless her. And from that stems an ancient custom that the morning of the wedding, the elders come to the kala, and they bless her. and they bring the veil down over her head, and that's what we call the Badekin. Today, we've put everything down. We've tramped down on our weddings. Instead of a wedding taking a whole day, like once upon a time, we're at after shul, everyone would walk the chassan home, and the elders would go to the kala and prepare her with her veil. And there was a whole procession. It was a whole day thing. Today, we do things chick-chack. We do the badekin at the wedding hall, and elders don't come anymore. It's the chassan that goes with the parents, and when the chassan puts down the veil, so some still have the custom that the two fathers will bless the kala. So that's the ancient custom. It goes back to Rebecca, that when Rebecca was leaving, so from Rebecca we learn this custom of having a veil, and from Rebecca we also have this custom of blessing the kala when she's going out towards the chassan. Yeah.
What's the reason for the veil?
So, in ancient times, the veil was a sign of virginity, meaning only a virgin would go out with a veil, and the veil to the wedding. And the veil was a sign: I am now leaving my father's house and going into my husband's house. It was so much of a sign that some learn that the commentary that the Jerusalem Talmud says, what's the chuppah of a virgin? The chuppah of a virgin is her covering of the veil. So some want to take that literally, that the actual putting down of the veil was such a known sign that here she's shifting from her father's house to her husband's house. That is the chuppah. Because chuppah means to cover, chofev. So which covering? Let's explain what we're talking about here. The Torah describes, we're going out to war, so you have a situation where a person is he is me'oras, and he has not yet brought her libeito. You have a person who is, in modern terminology, we call it engaged, but has not yet brought the bride to his home. So from here and other verses, we see that the Torah denotes two stages to marriage. There's the stage of kiddushin, otherwise known as erusin, otherwise known as biblical engagement. And then there is nisuin, which we might translate as marriage. So marriage has these two steps. And technically, biblically, after you put that ring on her finger and say, Hareyat mikudeshet liv tabat zo, she's legally mikudeshes. She is meureses, meaning what? That biblically the two are husband and wife, but their obligations to one another are limited. And then they have to undergo the next stage, which is nisuin, that he brings her into his home. Now, the rabbis saw that guys have a tendency to take advantage of girls. Why should I ever take on all the obligations of a ksuba? Why should I ever take on all the obligations of actually being married to you? Let's just do kiddushin. I don't owe you too much if we break up. Obviously, she's legally married to him.
They could have relations.
And he could do whatever he wants. And then he could walk away from her and not owe her too much. So Chazal came and said, the rabbis came and instituted 6 blessings plus the blessing on wine, which had total 7. And they said, when you bring her into chuppah, we are instituting 7 blessings that speak about how beautiful this idea that you two can actually unite physically is, and you may not. We hereby prohibit any man from being intimate with a woman before chuppah, before nisuin. So even though the Torah really allows it, the rabbis saw that people were taking advantage of it. They came along and said, kala below bracha, if you take a kala, if you marry a woman, and you don't finish off the marriage and give her a ksuba and do a nisuin and obligate yourself to everything that the Torah really wanted you to obligate yourself to, it's as though you're being intimate with a nida, with a woman who's having her menstruation. We hereby prohibit it. So the rabbis came and reframed the chuppah. They said, A, we prohibit intimacy beforehand. B, you will make 7 blessings through which you will appreciate that this unity is something holy and special and amazing, the way you're going to unify with your wife. So they instituted for us what we call Sheva Brachos, and they instituted a rabbinic prohibition for the couple to be intimate between Kiddushin and Nisuin. So then once you can't really do anything between Kiddushin and Nisuin, so then the custom evolved that we do it all under the chuppah all at once. We don't run into trouble. So today, when we get engaged, we're just basically committing to get married. It's not a halachic, biblical engagement. So today, we our process is as follows. You come to the wedding, you write up a ksuba. Because Chazal made another rabbinic prohibition, and they said, you're not allowed to spend one day with your wife unless she has a kosher ksuba. You don't have a ksuba, leave the house. Go write one up. You may not live with your husband without a ksuba. Why? Because Chazal wanted to protect the woman, that the husband wouldn't take advantage of her. He should know he's obligated. Not a situation where he says, I've had it with you. You get out of here. We're getting divorced right now to the Rabbanut. And she says, you kidding? You owe me $3 million if we get divorced. Which houses are you going to sell in order to divorce me? And he says, yeah, show me the contract. And she goes looking, and she says, actually, I can't find it. He says, I don't remember no $3 million. I think I only obligated myself to 200 monet, to 200 zuz. Yeah, I could afford those 20,000 shekel, no problem. Come, let's go to the Rabbanut.
Is there a copy of the Ketubah?
So today we keep a copy in the Rabbanut. But, so you can't play that game. But but Chazal forbade couples from living together even one day without a ksuba. So again, when we come to the wedding hall, we write up a ksuba because he can't marry her without it. And then he goes and covers her and he goes to the chuppah. She comes to the chuppah. He puts on the ring. The rabbi makes a blessing on his behalf, and that's kiddushin. He's saying, Arat mikudeshet li. He's doing the first stage. He's biblically marrying her. Now, that's the first stage, biblical engagement. Then we say the seven blessings, and then what happens is nisuin. How do we have nisuin? We say, now the canopy is going to serve like your home. Because back 150 years ago, most chassanim didn't own their own home. From the wedding, where would they go? To their in-laws. They'd go to the girl's house. Yeah, how's that for a honeymoon? They'd go from the wedding hall, and where they didn't have money for a wedding hall, where'd they get married? In the yard of the shul. They didn't have money. They take the curtain in front of the Arna Kodesh, and they'd use that as a canopy. That was their chuppah. And under that, they'd get married. And then they'd hang it up again on the Arna Kodesh. Under that, they'd get married. And then he'd go to his in-laws. Wow. Imagine life like that. So in order to facilitate that, he's supposed to bring her into his own home. What home does he have? So that canopy is his home. He doesn't own it, but technically that's like his home. So that's his chuppah. We have another custom, which is also recorded in the Jerusalem Talmud, that he goes into a private, secluded place where he sits down and eats some, drinks something with her. Today we call it the cheder yichud. It doesn't have to be, the Ashkenazim are careful that they're alone, that technically they could be intimate, because we just said, what is chuppah, what is nisuin? From here on in, she's in my home, and we can do whatever we want. We can be intimate together. But the Sfaradim say, no, it's just, you're showing that you're united. And that's what it says in the Jerusalem Talmud, that they used to sometimes make a little home, like a little room out of roses, out of flowers. They didn't really have privacy. No one thought they were going to do anything. And sometimes they didn't even eat the meal alone. Their buddies would join them, and they'd have a little, coffee and cake together out there in that room, and then they'd go and dance with everyone. So that's what the Sfaradim do today. Their cheder yichud is a communal cheder yichud. You know, people walk in, the photographers come in a little bit.
What's cheder yichud?
After the chuppah, so they go off to a room where they're alone. So Ashkenazim, they go in, and then it's just the chasan and the kala. They lock the door, and we have witnesses who stand outside the door for 9 minutes, and they're attesting that this couple was alone. They did nisuin. That's it. They went in alone.
What's the purpose of that?
That's the fulfillment of another opinion of what is the chuppah. The chuppah is either the canopy we're standing under, or I take her to my house. I'm taking her into a room that signifies that now we're married. We're going into that room alone. Not that anything really happens in that room, but something theoretically could have happened in that room. So that's what we're showing by going into the room and spending 9 minutes there. That's, we say 9 minutes is the amount of time that technically is what it would take. Say there. The witnesses stand outside the door for 9 minutes and then they leave. And what the couple does inside is they sit down and eat something. But technically what they're showing is they break their fast, right? They eat and drink.
Right, so the sin originally in the Torah is just literally just, hi, come home, like come to my home, that's it? Just come
Nisuin to my home? Technically is, he takes her to his home with the understanding he's taking her for marriage, right? Doesn't even have to be his own home. It could be a Holiday Inn. With the understanding that you're coming in to be my wife, where we are now going. Technically, but it's not exactly mine. I don't own the inn, I don't own the chuppah, but it's as if it was mine. It's something that signifies you are now coming, we're now building a home together. So so that's our marriage. So Rebecca is on her way.
About the chuppah, you said it's like a house, but how could, it's not even a deer, like people are holding the poles. The second people, it's not even a deer at the
right. Right, because it's like a social norm. I don't even own the chuppah, I don't own the poles, I don't own the ground, I don't own the canopy I'm under. So what? According to some communities had the custom that he would wear a talis and then drape the talis over her, and that was the chuppah, because his chuppah means to cover. So he's covering her with his talis. He's taking her under his wing, under his talis.
They do that stuff?
I did that with my wife. The Yekis do that. Some Sephardim do, yeah, okay.
They do what?
That you take your talis and you spread it over your kala. Spread. Okay. So, Eliezer comes back with Rebecca, and she sees a man walking through a field. Now, that's not so comfortable to walk through a field. So obviously, he's approaching them. He's not taking the route around. He's not walking on the beaten path. He's crossing through the field towards them. And he has just finished davening Mincha. Yitzchak is the one that instituted Mincha as a permanent prayer for the Jewish people. And she looks at him, and she sees a holy man. So she asks the servant, "Who's that?" She's wondering, is that Abraham or is that my chassan? So Eliezer says, "That's my master." So she slips off the camel and puts the veil down. And as she slips off the camel, she wounds herself. And she loses her virginity. So that night, when they come home, Yitzchak is a little bit surprised. What's going on here? So she says, "Well, when I slipped off the camel, I wounded myself." So Yitzchak says, "Where?" And he goes back to the spot, and a deer runs up and starts pushing the sand at that spot. And Yitzchak sees that there's still blood there. So one Medrash says that that's why we have a mitzvah to cover the blood of the deer. We have a mitzvah when we slaughter a wild animal to cover their blood, and that's because they proved that Rivka was really okay. That's one Medrash. There's another Medrash that says that when Yitzchak came home, his father said to him, "She just had a long journey with this guy. How do you know she's still a virgin? You better check." And then the Medrash says that Avram told Yitzchak, you shouldn't marry her if you don't know if she's been faithful on the way home. And the Medrash says that she was faithful. And because Eliezer was suspected of doing something wrong when he really didn't, so that's why, according to one Medrash, Eliezer is one of the few tzaddikim who walked into the Garden of Eden alive. He walked in, whatever that means. Means he never had to suffer through death. And according to another Medrash, he was given his reward in this world, and he became Og, that giant, the king of the city of Bashan, and he lived for hundreds of years until he was finally killed by Moshe. And according to that Medrash, that's why Moshe was fearful of Og. Why was he scared? Because he knew he had all the merits of all the years that he had served Avraham. Yeah. Okay, so you're saying would that still be the same Eliezer? Maybe, but then would it would fit that he was such a fine person if he was worthy of surviving the flood?
They're saying that Og and Eliezer is the same guy.
Correct.
Really,
it's very interesting because he ended up.
I thought that Eliezer was a Canaanite.
So was Og.
How?
He was the king of Bashan. He was the king of that area in Canaan.
Yeah, but there was no Canaan before the flood.
Ah, so that's a good point, right? If Og was from before the flood, then he couldn't have been a Canaanite, right? You're right, so that doesn't fit. You're right, that's a good point. That's true, right?
No, I mean, like, you have the English people who came to America, and afterwards they became Americans. You live in an area, and you can be associated with them.
Okay, maybe.
No, but Canaanite as in like you are a descendant of Canaan.
Right, the Rashi seems that way.
Otherwise, Abraham would be a Canaanite because Abraham lives in Canaan and owns Hebron. But he's
right. That's a good point, yeah. Okay, so whichever way we go, these are all Midrashim. Yitzchak brings Rivka into the tent. And he loves her. So there's an interesting word that appears with regards to Yitzchak. The word ahava. And you'll notice that the word ahava shows up revolving around Yitzchak all the time. This week's parsha, next week's parsha. You're going to see many times that the word ahava shows up. So here we have another concept. The pasuk says he brought her into the tent and then he loved her. So people think they love a person before they're married, but the truth is that true love develops afterwards, after you bring her to the tent and you deal. He brings her to the tent of Sarah. What does that mean? So here we have a very interesting tradition that when a parent passes away and the child gets married, then the parent's soul comes to witness the child's happiness. So the Medrash says he brought her to the tent of Sarah, his mother, meaning Sarah, his mother, was there to witness his happiness in marriage. Someone quoted to me a Medrash I never saw inside that says that when a spouse passes away, so then when that spouse remarries, so then the spouse that passed away, their spirit comes to witness their happiness and wishes them well at their wedding. So that I never saw inside, but someone quoted that. Okay, Chazal say that Sarah's tent was unique. There was always a lamp lit. There was always a cloud hovering over the tent. And there was always bread. There was always fresh dough ready to be used in her tent. So that corresponds to the three mitzvahs of a woman. Challah, Nida, and Hadlakas Haner. They were careful in those three mitzvahs, so they had blessing in those three areas. The cloud represents the water of that the Nida immerses in. The Challah is obvious, and the Hadlakas Haner is also obvious. Okay. Avram gives Yitzchak gifts. And he gives Yitzchak everything he owns. And the question here is, our sages say, you shouldn't do that. Don't go giving gifts to one son over another son. You're making fights. So there are many interpretations here. One interpretation is that technically Yishmael and Avram were both Gerim. That Avram underwent a gear process with the circumcision. So technically, halachically, he didn't inherit him at all. So Avram had to step forward and give him a bunch of gifts, and that was what he would get. And Yitzchak was born after the Bris Mila process. You could say, what? So that's... If a person converts and his son converts... this is a funny story. I was once talking to a family that of converts where the father converted and the son's converted and the daughter's converted. There are many families like that. So the son was telling me, you know, I'm getting married and my dad is only giving $10,000 to the wedding and I want a fancy wedding and he's not willing to give me $15,000 and he could afford it. So I looked at him and I said, dunce, if it was your real father, it wouldn't be right that you're making demands on him. He doesn't owe you anything. Being that you underwent gear and he underwent gear, he doesn't owe you, he really doesn't owe you anything. If the halacha considered him your father, he still wouldn't owe you anything. He doesn't owe you anything towards the marriage. But here, you know, you're telling me he owes you and you don't owe him. He doesn't owe you anything, that's for sure. You probably still owe him out of Akar Satov. You owe him a certain element of Kibbut Avim, and maybe as much Kibbut Avim, but he doesn't owe you. So that's the idea here. Avram doesn't owe Yishmael anything, really, technically, legally. He's a ger and he's a ger. They both underwent gear with the circumcision.
So what does that have to do with who's your father?
So two gerim, if they undergo gear, then their relation isn't obligatory. Meaning, technically, biblically, a mother could marry her son after they undergo gear. Technically. Halachically, it's not so, but technically. Technically, it's considered like they're starting from scratch.
All the children that Abraham has with
Keturah, right? You're saying that doesn't answer that. So the Torah identifies Avram's wives as pilagshim. What does the word pilagish mean? So one understanding is that the word pilagish is plag isha, half a wife, where you're not obligating her yourself to her like another wife. What's a pilagish? So Rashi says a pilagish is a woman who you're not obligating yourself to give her a ksuba. Right? In the ksuba, you're writing, I will feed you, I will clothe you, I will take care of you, and if in the event of divorce or my passing, I will give you such and such a sum of money. And pilegesh is the capacity to agree with the woman, we will stay together until we want to split.
It's basically a girlfriend.
Oh, so it's a little different than a girlfriend, because it would seem, according to Rashi, that you do kiddushin, harat mekudeshetli, and maybe even do nisuin just without a ksuba. And the only issue is that you have to agree on it, that this is what we're doing. Where it's going to be a pilegish stature, and then if the two agree to split up, they split up. So why am I saying this? Because the verse in Divrei Hayomim in Chronicles, the verse calls Keturah his pilegish. The verse says Keturah pilegish Avram. So it identifies their marriage as such. Now here we have an interesting machlokes, the Talmud in Sanhedrin comes to identify what is a pilegish. So Rashi learns that a pilegish you do kiddushin to. You do say areat mikudeshet li. So she's separate from everyone else, but there's no ksuba. The Ramban says, no, that's not what it says there in the Talmud. Ksuba is a rabbinic institution. We discussed that earlier. The rabbis instituted ksuba. So the Ramban says, no, what the Talmud says over there, Rashi had the wrong version. The correct version of Talmud is that a pilegish doesn't have kiddushin either. So if you want her to be a pilegish, what that means is you could send her off whenever you want without obligation, and the children don't inherit it. This isn't the marriage. So that was the understanding. Keturah and he decided to live together, but he wasn't obligated to the kids. That was the deal with the pilegish in those days. The Rabbein Bechaye and the Ramban say that Avram for sure took care of her and took care of his kids. But the reason she's called a pilegish was because she came from a family of slaves. So then the question is, how come Avram's telling Yitzchak, don't marry slaves, but he himself does? So the answer that's given is, he knew his future was in Yitzchak. Once he got that out of the way, he could do whatever he wants. Meaning he knows he has to build the people of Israel. God told him, Yitzchak is your future. So now he has to remarry. He marries Keturah. What we see here is another idea, and that is that all the formulas are very nice, but at the end of the day, the question is, who's the human being? There are all kinds of formulas when it comes to Yichus. They asked Rabbi Feinstein, the Talmud says that if a child is born from a woman who didn't go to mikvah, then that child is going to have bad traits and you shouldn't marry that child. So they asked Rabbi Feinstein, should I go out with someone who is chozer b'tshuva? Their mother probably didn't go to mikvah. So Rabbi Feinstein, and everyone says the same answer. He's not the only one that says it. He says, you dated the guy or you dated the girl or you checked out the guy or the girl and they have a good reputation and they're nice people. So the Talmud says that they won't be nice people if their mother was a nida when she had relations with her husband. So yeah, what probably happened? Probably before he was born, she went swimming in a pool, which was a kosher mikvah. She went to the lake, which was a kosher mikvah. She went swimming in the ocean, which was a kosher mikvah. Something happened, because you see, the formula doesn't work, right? He's a nice guy, she's a nice guy, so don't worry about it. So that's what I'm saying, all these formulas are nice in theory. But in practice, you see, Avram also married a woman when it made sense, and then we look for all kinds of answers. But if it makes sense, the person's a good person, so then, so long as it's in the confines of what's permissible, all these ideas of preferable, well, they're not 100% formulas. Once you're working with preferences, so then you say, okay, let's see the facts on the ground. Yeah?
You said that she came from a family of slaves. Unless he was a daughter of a king.
Right, and Mitzrayim was the son of Ham, right? Okay, so it says that Avram passed away Saveam. What does it mean, Savea? Satisfied, right? So the Medrash says that Tzadikim merit to pass away from the world satisfied. They see their accomplishments. They see what's coming in the world to come. And that's one of the gifts to Tzadikim. And guys, bear that in mind, because you have to compare this with what we're learning in Koheles, where Koheles is deeply unsatisfied. Well, what's with this world, right? So the Medrash says that Tzadikim do merit to go satisfied. So here we have another Medrash that says one of the gifts that God gave the matriarchs was that they passed away first. That it's a very difficult thing for a woman to live life as a widow. The husbands can get, you see, they all managed. But the women, God gave them that gift, that Sarah passes away in Avram's life, etc. Rivka passes away, yeah. So, when it comes time to bury Avraham Avinu, the Pasuk points out that Yitzchak and Yishmael buried him. So Rashi says, yeah, Yishmael did tshuva. So that's important because that's why you find rabbis named Rabbi Yishmael. Because Yishmael wasn't such a bad guy after all. You see, the Talmud says there was a kid named Doeg ben Yosef. And his mother used to measure him. And every time he'd grow a little bit, she would give that much gold to the temple. And then towards the time of the destruction of the second temple, as the famine reigned in the city, she ended up eating his flesh. So the Talmud says that the name you give a child affects his end. Doeg is the name of an evil person. And the Talmud says she shouldn't have named him Doeg. Doeg was an evil person. The Mishnah says he doesn't merit the world to come. So Tosfos asks, but we find in the Talmud rabbis named all kinds of interesting names, like Shechna or Yishmael. So the Tosfos answers, this is only a concern if that name is automatically associated only with him. But if there are multiple people with that name, some were good and some were bad, so then you could use that name because it's not specifically him. Akiva is a name that we don't find until Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva died a gruesome death. So that's why parents were careful when they named their child Akiva, we spell it with a hey, not an aleph. Even David, parents were careful when they'd name their child David, they'd add a yud. There used to be a custom that when they'd write the name David as a child's name, they'd write it Dalit Vav Yud Dalit. I don't know of anyone that still has that custom, but...
Why David?
So Chazal say that David and Doeg were on two opposite sides of the spectrum, and that's why David and Doeg have the same numerical value. And for whatever reason, they saw that it's better not to have the same numerical value, even if you're going to be named David. So for whatever reason, they were careful about that. Who else do we have? Yeshaya.
But in our day,
people don't call their child Yeshayahu. They call him Yeshaya. Why? Because Yeshaya, there was one Yeshaya, and he died a very gruesome death. His own grandson cut his head off. So people today are more careful when it comes to someone who dies young. If someone dies young, they don't name after him without adding a name or something. But the Chassam Sofer quotes this idea that people were careful with anyone that died a gruesome death. So Yishmael, well, he didn't end up being a wicked person. He ended up doing tshuva. So that's why he let Yitzchak come first. Yeah. Okay. The parsha ends with the descendants of Yishmael. There's a whole Gemara about how why we need to know all of this in order to figure out calculations of how many years Yaakov Avinu spent in yeshiva. Yishmael passes away, and he passes away without suffering, without being ill. And this is what people merit if they're doing what's right in life. That's what Rashi quotes. And there's a medrash that says the exact opposite. There's a medrash that says that the word gvi'a means that a person dies a gruesome, horrible, painful death, and that's what tzaddikim merit, because that cures them. When a person suffers, so that atones for whatever he had to suffer in the world to come. And there's a medrash over here. The medrash says, "Yimtzaehu be'eretz midbar." The verse says that's Avram. There's a mashal of a king that went out with his soldiers out into the desert, and when problems came up, so they always ran away. The soldiers all ran away. Anytime they were attacked, they ran away. And one brave soldier, anytime the other soldiers would retreat and run away, he'd stand by the king and say, "Don't worry, I'm with you. And I promise that I'm not leaving you until you get back to the palace in peace and you're lying in bed peacefully. I'm not leaving you." So that's what the verse says. Hashem tells Avram, "I am Hashem who took you out of Ur Kasdim." What Hashem was saying is, "I was with you when you were thrown into the furnace. I'm not leaving you. Don't worry about it." Yisovivenu, the Pasuk says. Hashem tells Avram, go around the planet. Yivoninehu, what does it mean? He gives him understanding that until Avram Avinu came along, so it's as though God wasn't recognized in the world. Very few people recognized him. Then Avram Avinu came and made Hashem famous. And then the pasuk says Yitzirenu, he watches over him ki yishonei, no, like the pupil of his eye. Hashem asks Avraham Avinu. The Medrash says if Hashem would have asked Avraham Avinu for the pupil of his eye, he would have given it, and not even not only the pupil of his eye, but even the his own son. Hashem asked him; he was willing to do that. So that's the Medrash on the pasuk that Avraham was willing to dedicate everything to Hashem. So,
what is that an expression? I watch over you like the pupil of my eye.
Yeah, throughout Tanakh. Yeah. Yeah. So that's, and that brings us now to the story of Yitzhak, which is where we'll pick up next week.